This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate weeks with our other co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz. With me in the studio is David Moxley running the board, and by phone, a very special guest, Dr. Richard Armstrong, whom I will formally introduce in just a minute. Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, who promotes education and freedom of choice in healthcare. We are here to educate you, the listener, on the things that you need to know, whether you're a physician or not. So starting with this week, the Doctor's Lounge show sort of settles into a regular rate and rhythm, if you will, for 2015. We started off the year with my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, hosting Congressman Tom Price in an outstanding show the first Thursday of January following New Year's. And after that, last week, Dr. Hal and I were on the show together, which was a lot of fun, and I always learn a lot from Hal doing those things. But now we're going to settle in to sort of the meat and potatoes of 2015. And as we do that, I want to return to one of the goals that I have for this program, which is to re-educate, right? That's what Docs for Patient Care Foundation is all about. It's about education and empowerment. So we want to re-educate everyone, including our fellow physicians, about, and this is kind of my spin on this, kind of who physicians really are, right? Who we are, how we think, why we do what we do, what drives us, what motivates us, what intimidates us. And that may sound a little trite here on the microphone, behind the microphone, but really it's kind of important because there are many competitive stakeholders, let's call them that, competitive stakeholders in the healthcare system, things besides doctors and patients, insurers, hospitals, politicians who want to convince you, who want to indoctrinate you, that there's nothing special about who doctors are, that people who touch patients for a living aren't special, that we're just cogs in a machine and even could be replaced by less trained individuals or even untrained individuals armed with, you know, comparative effectiveness protocols or even computers, right? I mean, there are some people in the health IT industry who think you can put a white jacket on IBM's Watson supercomputer and replace physicians with something different with machines. So it is my intention what I aspire to is to teach you, right? If you're a physician, to reacquaint you with who physicians are, with what the art and science of medicine is all about, and what makes medicine and those who practice it very unique and very special people. So why would healthcare's competitive stakeholders, you know, hospitals, insurers, politicians, the government, why would they want to mislead you about who doctors really are? What do they hope to gain? Well, part of it is that these folks don't see doctors as who we really are. They don't see us as responsible and devoted stewards of our patients' health. They see us in a completely different light. They see us as holders of great financial and potentially political power, right? I mean, if our GDP is $16 trillion and change per year and healthcare controls a sixth of it, that means that the decisions that physicians make talking with patients in exam rooms directs the spending of over $2 trillion, maybe about $2.6 trillion per year. And these other competitive stakeholders can't stand that. They can't stand that doctors have that much of it, and they want a piece of that pie. Certainly, they already have a big piece of that pie, but they always want more. They always want bigger and bigger stuff. So from Medicare to managed care to Obamacare, they have been successful in extracting a bigger and bigger piece of that and wrestling that away from doctors and patients where it belongs and taking that power where it's not going to do any good and it's certainly going to do any harm. We physicians see it differently, right? We see the whole world differently than that. We're pretty oblivious to all that power, in a sense, as we should be, right? All we see is us, the physician, and the patient, and we're having a conversation with that patient in an exam room, and we're building that doctor-patient relationship, and that's really all we see. We're pretty oblivious to all this other money and power and politics and stuff that kind of swirls around outside that exam room, and that's good in one sense. That's good in one sense because it keeps docs grounded. We don't get all messed up mentally about that and have it affect the decisions that we make about patients. And that part's good. It's good. The problem is it's also bad. And it's bad because we are oblivious to all of that. It gives us a certain level of naivete, and as a result, we've been very reluctant because we've been very unaware to get involved in what I consider to be part of our Hippocratic Oath, part of our duty to our patients, which is to manage and defend our profession against these other competitive stakeholders. And, you know, as Dr. Armstrong and I are going to talk about this hour, that can be a very frustrating thing to watch happen, especially if you're one of the few of us that have become motivated and passionate about defending our profession, protecting our profession, making people understand who we are and what needs to happen. But there may be a glimmer of hope. There may be a glimmer of hope that's come up as a result of the recent midterm election and two major issues within medicine that we're going to talk about. One is the maintenance of certification. The other is electronic medical records. But there is some signs that docs as a group are finally beginning to wake up and understand the other part of our duties in terms of advocating for our patients. So to help me talk about this today, I am delighted. I am honored. I am humbled to have the best way I can describe Dick Armstrong is he's the guy I want to be when I grow up. You know, he is the embodiment of what makes medicine special and what makes doctors special. I first met Dick at a few years ago, one of our first, you know, trips to Washington, D.C. back 5 years ago when, you know, we were naive and we thought a couple of trips to Washington was all it took to change things. And, you know, I was totally clueless. I was totally clueless about all this stuff. And Dick was kind enough to take me under his wing and show me how to learn, how to start to become an effective advocate outside the exam room for my patients and for my colleagues. Dr. Armstrong is a general surgeon. He practices in one of the most beautiful places on earth, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. If we were going to go through all of his credentials, it'd take up the whole hour. But to summarize, he's a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. He is the chief operating officer for Docs for Patient Care. He is a member of the board for Docs for Patient Care Foundation, a board member of the Benjamin Rush Institute, and perhaps most importantly for this conversation, he is a medical advisor to CIRMO. Now, what is CIRMO? Well, if you're a doctor and you don't know what CIRMO is, you need to learn. CIRMO is the largest physician-only communications blog in the country. It may be getting ready to expand beyond those borders. It's about 300,000 physicians, or about 40% of all docs. And we were able to, well, not we, CIRMO, was able to grow that to 30% with no government incentives, no penalties, none of that. This is just physician interest that is driving that sort of thing. So, Dick, thanks so much for being on the program. This is a very important day for both of us. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks a lot, Mike, and I'm humbled, and it is cold up here. I wish sometimes that I was in Atlanta with you, but I guess the traffic down there is too bad, and I didn't have any cars in front of me when I drove to work this morning.
Well, I tell you what, yeah, you'd come down for a while. I doubt you'd stay for long. I think you'd, I think you'd miss it pretty quickly as you sat in traffic on your way to work every day.
Okay.
But so let's talk about this. I mean, you know, why are physicians so reluctant to get out of the exam room and the operating room and engage this kind of thing?
Well, I think that you summarized it pretty well, but I think that there's a lot of other things. And at first, we wrote some notes yesterday, and I'll just run through some of these. First thing is doctors are busy, and so they lack the time to inform themselves and educate themselves and fully understand the issues, which are very complex. And so, you know, my wife always tells me that if I was in my old private practice and working the hours that I used to work, I would never pay attention to any of this. I would just want to go come home at night and get some dinner and go to bed. Uh-huh. And she's right. And so a lot of doctors just aren't able to do it. They can't. They don't have the time to do it. And then the other thing is, and this is very important, too. If doctors are employed, which a lot are right now, and if they are in a good working environment, and if they're receiving what they feel is a fair salary, most of them just aren't upset. They just want to do their work and go home. And then dealing with national health care issues is a distraction. It really isn't fun, and it requires a lot of extra effort. And the other thing is that a lot of physicians assume that this job is really either being done by their professional associations or should be done by their professional associations, and as long as they pay their dues, it's really not their responsibility.
Well, and a lot of those professional organizations will tell their members in order to get their dues paid every year that they are doing that job.
Well, right.
Maybe they really think that's true. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons we're having this conversation, and honestly one of the reasons that Docs for Patient Care formed in 2009, was we felt a large hole in that, a big lack of the major organizations being advocates for physicians, and we needed to speak up. And I think that's going on again right now, and we'll talk about that as it goes on.
Well, yeah, go on. We need to there's two major issues that talk about that to talk about the maintenance of certification and electronic medical records,
right,
and some of the frustrations that, that you know you and I have personally seen about getting the membership of physicians involved in this kind of thing.
Well, currently the maintenance of certification issue, which we'll talk about in detail, so that the non-physicians out there can understand this, has created an incredible amount of turmoil, and it is directly affecting every physician, whether you're employed or not. And it's viewed as an expensive burden with no proven benefit or justification, except to financially support the various specialty boards. And it doctors see it as just one more straw in the straw that's finally breaking a camel's back, and that is that burdens are added onto us every day, different kinds of regulatory burdens and rules and hoops to jump through. And this one, doctors just don't see it as necessary. So if you want to talk a little bit about what that is, we can do that right now.
Okay. I mean, that's, you know, there's, you know, personally, I don't have any personal axe to grind with this. In my specialty, I'm grandfathered out, but I watch in our practice what our younger colleagues have to go through.
Right.
And even I didn't really understand how bad it was till I researched it for today's program. But it's a big problem. Go ahead.
It's a huge problem. Well, traditionally, you know, doctors go to medical school, and that's 4 years, and then they do a residency, which can range anywhere from 3 to 7 years or even more, depending upon fellowships. And then following residency several years ago, prior to the 1990s, 1980s, it used to be that once you finished your training program in your specialty, then you were told by your program director that you were qualified to take the board exam. And so you would have a board exam, like in surgery. And in surgery, it included a written examination and an oral test. And if you passed both of those, then you became board certified. And in the years past, once you did that, that was it. You were done. Now, we all learned that you weren't done learning, and everybody needed to learn throughout their careers. But you had completed this milestone in your life, and you got to put your plaque on the wall, and you were board certified.
And let's be clear too, Dick, at this point, that you know, in opposing maintenance of certification, we are not suggesting for a minute that continuing education doesn't need to go on, that docs don't need to stay current, and that there is already a mechanism called CME that has been in place for a long time to ensure that occurs.
That's absolutely correct, and it's difficult sometimes to thread that argument, because a lot of the people that are in favor of this entire process try to paint those who are opposed to it for different reasons as being against continuing education or quality education, and nothing could be further from the truth. And fortunately, we are now being joined by people in academics who are interested in talking about this, and not just private practice physicians, and the boards are listening. I can tell you that from my own personal experience, which is good. Now, whether it will change or not, we don't know. But I'll go on. So after residency, you became board certified, and then in the early, in the 80s and early 90s, the boards then developed this idea that people needed to be recertified, that one certification wasn't enough. And so every once in a while, I think for family medicine, it's every 7 years, for surgery, it's every 10 years, you had to take another examination to re-up your certification. Well, this started an industry. Basically a testing industry that funneled money directly to the boards and to a big CME board complex, which is a huge amount of money. So there's a great financial incentive for this to continue.
Tell you what, we're coming up on a hard break. I hate to stop you mid-sentence.
No, that's okay.
But we're going to go to the break and come back. It's 15 minutes after the hour. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock for Medicine on Call. On Medicine on Call, we talk about more than medicine. It's about how to take control of your mind, body, and spirit.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. With me in the studio is David Moxley on the board. The coffee's hot and the doctors are talking. My very special guest this morning is Dr. Richard Armstrong. He is one of the smartest docs I know about the sort of issues that we are talking about. And if you are one of a growing group of doctors who are mad as you know what over MOC, Obamacare, electronic medical records, and you don't want to take it anymore, and you want to channel your frustration into actionable, useful, intelligent things, Dr. Armstrong is the man that you need to learn as much as you can from. Welcome back, Dick. Thank you.
Again, I don't deserve that praise, Mike, but thank you very much.
Well, you have been kind enough to take me under your wing for these 5 years, and you know I'd be lost without you on so much of this.
Okay.
So we were talking about the history behind this maintenance of certification concept. So
recertification developed, and that's where we left it. And people kind of accepted that without too much trouble, because even though, you know, everybody kind of thinks it's a pain in the neck and you have to go through this test again, at least in our specialty, general surgery, the American College of Surgeons publishes excellent educational tools. There's a thing called the CSAP examination, and you do actually learn a few updated things about areas of your practice or specialty that you don't see always. And the recertification exam, I think, at least I've done it 3 times, and it's not that much fun, but it's at least relatively fair. But then on top of this, this new idea progressed since the turn of the century, called maintenance of certification. And this is a whole different ball of wax. These are kind of make-work projects where you have to do all kinds of things, hand-washing demonstrations, surveys to patients. It depends on what specialty you're in, but it continues on, and it's very, very expensive. And it takes time away from your practice. It takes time away from your family life. And there honestly is, it's disconnected from everything. There's really no proven benefit that it helps. Now, the boards are trying to sell this to everyone as, oh, the public is demanding this. This is for quality. Well, there's no proof of that. And there's definitely no proof that this is being demanded by the public. So this has really brought physicians together. People have gotten up in arms about this, and there's a lot going on nationally right now, thanks to some of the people that we've been associated with in Docs for Patient Care and others that are really taking the fight seriously. One of them is Dr. Paul Kempen, who's an anesthesiologist, used to be with the Cleveland Clinic. Everybody on CIRMO knows Paul. And another is the doctor out in California who developed the website Change Board Recertification, which I would recommend everyone go to. But there are more, and they're developing, and groups of doctors around the country have done a tremendous job working on this problem and advocating for their colleagues. And I think that this is coming to a head, and the more people that get involved, the more the boards will listen, and they are listening, and we'll see what happens, but hopefully this will turn around.
Well, you know, in researching some of this, because again, I'm personally grandfathered out of it, so I haven't had my nose rubbed in it the way so many others have. But I was shocked at all of the – I mean, this isn't just a matter of taking another test. This isn't a matter of just doing a board review course and taking a test. There's a whole other body of data, I think, that includes, like you said, patient satisfaction and case histories. And, you know, you have to submit records of all the cases that you've done since the last time you did it. I mean, there's really a lot more to do, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot more to do. And some of it's really silly. And then the other important point about this is that these participation in the maintenance of certification efforts and recertification have become tied to credentialing for insurance plans, credentialing for hospital privileges. And so people that don't jump through these hoops can actually lose their practice or lose their job or lose their ability to bill certain insurance companies. And so it's a very large threat. And I think that it's unjustified. In fact, one of the most recent interesting developments is from the guy who is the chief of cardiology at the Scripps Clinic, Dr. Paul Tierstein. And if you there's a Medscape article, if you look up Dr. Paul Tierstein, Tierstein, he and a group of academic colleagues have responded to this by forming their own board. Which is really interesting. Now, we don't know exactly where that's going to go, and there's been a lot of commentary about that on CIRMO and in other areas, and there may be some difficulties with that, and we don't need to go over those details right now, but this is one of the responses that gives people some hope that we're all in this together and we may be able to make some significant changes.
And, you know, there's a lot of money involved.
An incredible amount of money.
I think I came across a figure of about $350 million across, you know, all of the specialties for all of the separate boards.
Yeah, or so, even more. I would recommend that people go to Dr. Wes Fisher's blogspot. It's called Dr. Wes's Blogspot, and there's a lot of articles on there that they can read about that. Or go to the website changeboardrecertification.com, and I would recommend, and this is a pitch for our friends that are doing this, I would recommend that people, doctors especially, donate to that effort because it all the information is right there. And again, it's not about not learning. It's not about keeping up with your specialty. Frankly, the best maintenance of certification is going to work every day because people who are actively practicing have to keep up with their specialty or they can't do it.
Sure, and I think, you know, the vast majority of physicians sort of just accept that as part of the facts of life, that yes, you go to meetings, you get education online, you devote time to this, and that's been sort of a decades long respected, accepted, established tradition that's what you do. So, you know, again, I think we need to say it as many times as we can. This is not advancing the a notion that you know don't need any more education after you're done. Far from it. Obviously, you know, research comes out, practice standards change, but we learn from each other every day. We talk to each other, and now that we have sort of online things like CIRMO and others, the options for maintaining your fund of knowledge and your skill set have become broader than ever.
Right.
And in ironically, in light of that, you know, the MOC structure tries to narrow that down and say, you know, nothing is worthwhile except for the material that we give you.
Well, right. And not only that, but they're definitely trying to codify a monopoly in that area as they are the only, quote, recognized board, the American Board of Medical Specialties. And there's even language in the Affordable Care Act to help them with that, which got in there. If you read on Dr. Wes's blogspot, there's some interesting information about the people that travel back and forth between the boards and working for CMS and how that language developed. But it's in there, and it's an onerous thing, and it's one of those things that we pointed out long ago when we opposed the Affordable Care Act. This was one of the smaller reasons, but it turns out not to be so small, really.
No, indeed, and it's these things that add up. I mean, if you add this to, you know, HIPAA and EMR and all these other, you know, regulatory bodies and bodies of regulations that you have to consider every day when you go to work, that, you know, again, the practice of medicine overall becomes harder and harder to do.
Right.
So
Maybe this is a good time to move into what you just mentioned, EMR, which is kind of your area.
Yeah, that's true, and we've talked about that here before. And, you know, again, a bit of history is in order. I mean, remember back in 2008, Dick, when there were no regulations they were being thought about, but there was no, you know, push from the government, no meaningful use or high-tech program. There were some statistics out there that showed that, you know, under free market pressures, only 4% of physician practices had what was described as a fully functional EMR. So you say, well, that's not very much, but the interesting part was that that small percentage of doctors was happy with what they had. The other 96% of docs who chose not to do electronic medical records weren't just laissez-faire about it. As a group, they said, no, we've looked at this and we really, really think it's a bad idea. And, you know, the appropriate conclusion from that is that 4% of docs, you know, were as a group of early adopters. And our practice was among that group in 2008 that said, yes, we understand that off the shelf these systems are useless, but, you know, we are unique among practices because we have the resources to take that unfinished product and finish it in a way that serves us so that, you know, the machines serve us, but not the other way around. And the problem is very few practices have those resources. And, you know, the meaningful use program did several bad things, you know, one of which is that it forced these practices that considered EMR and said, look, this is not in our interest, this is not in our patients' interest, we think it's a bad idea. So on the supply side, there's a bad effect because you're forcing those people to buy it. On the supply side, you know, you basically took away every incentive that the electronic medical records vendors had to improve their products. What should have happened is that the EMR vendors got together with that small 4% and said, how are you doing it? You know, you guys are happy. Everybody else hates it. What's the secret sauce? What are you guys doing? And, you know, when meaningful use came along, you know, that didn't have to happen because now everybody, you know, they were selling EMRs like hotcakes and there was no incentive to do anything. And it took sort of big vendors like, you know, Epic and Cerner and turned them into, you know, 400-pound gorillas. And, you know, as a result, you know, we're now in a situation where, you know, it's almost like Obamacare. It's kind of like it's a problem, but how do we unwind it? How do we undo it? Because now, you know, docs have spent billions and billions of dollars on these things. They've got systems in their office they hate. You know, we know from, you know, recent surveys, one from November of 2013 that, you know, says that, you know, most of the docs that have EMR don't like them. About 70% of them think it wasn't worth the money. 70% of them wouldn't buy the EMR again if they were free to turn back the clock and not have to buy it. They think that it negatively impacts patient care, that it's hurt their practices financially. And because of the incentives, there's been no push from the vendors to look at the interoperability issues, to look at the workflow issues. You know, the example of, you know, the death of America's first Ebola patient, which was quickly suppressed, you know, in a very strange turn of events where one day the hospitals get up in front of that hospital in Dallas, you know, gets in front of a press conference and says, you know what, we had a problem with the EMR and that was to blame. And 24 hours later, they say, no, we were just kidding. You know, that's, you know, you wonder what happened there. You know, you truly wonder. But clearly, you know, the EMR couldn't even present data within itself to, you know, do this whole concept of clinical decision support, which is so heavily pushed.
Right.
And so, you know, we've got, you know, huge problems with this, and now that the problem is finally getting recognized, you know, we still haven't addressed the question of, you know, how we unwind this or how as a profession we extract ourselves from the predicament.
Well, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, one of the things that has to happen is that these issues have to become mainstream, and that means that the larger organizations in the country need to pick this up and run with it and decide who's right and who's wrong. And one of the things that happened with the American College of Surgeons, which is our organization, for surgeons, is that at their last meeting in San Francisco, they heard the message loud and clear from the membership. And so the American College of Surgeons has put a working group together to discuss this issue on their blog, which is actively going on now.
Okay. I tell you what, we're coming up on hard break.
Okay.
We are at about 29 and a half minutes after the hour. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to the Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. It is 30 minutes after the hour. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate weeks with our other co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz. And with me in the studio is very special guest, Dr. Dick Armstrong. And Dick, we were talking before the break about how some physician groups are slowly beginning to wake up and understand how widespread the unrest is, and you were telling that story regarding the American College of Surgeons. So I'm going to get out of the way and let you keep going.
Right, and there's no question about that. And the ACS leadership understand that everybody's upset. They just don't really know what direction to go in to figure out how to do this. And I think that people are realizing that what you said earlier, the meaningful use program, really distorted the market, and that we know, in fact, I've talked to many people in business and the vendors that produce some of these smaller EMR systems. You know, we just had a meeting here at our hospital with the president of the company that we use, and he told us we would rather work for you guys, but we spend 95% of our time trying to meet meaningful use requirements in our software.
Well, that's the same thing I heard from our EMR vendor years ago, and we have one of the biggest ones in the market. And that's exactly what we heard in 2008, Dick. After we had about 5 years of experience with our EMR, we said, you know, we're getting good at this. You know, maybe the vendor would be listening to our suggestions on how to make it better, or, you know, how to move the ball and maybe make an ENT-ready product. And that we heard exactly the same thing, Dick. You know, sorry, we're so covered up with meaningful use, we can't even talk to you, and we don't even know when we're going to be able to talk to you.
Right. So it's obvious what physicians need. I mean, it's like everything else in the market. You know, people, when Apple came out with iPads, all the people that were stuck using laptop computers looked at the iPad and said, what would anybody want that for? You know?
Exactly.
But it turned out that a product like the iPad is a very functional product, a very portable product, and for many people it helps their day go better, it makes their workflow better, it makes them better at meetings. So doctors need the same thing. I mean, if somebody could hand us an electronic version of the chart that we used to thumb through at the nursing station or in our offices, but it just worked. It just worked like an iPad works, and it was smart so that it could do everything you needed it to do. It could interconnect with the internet for references. It could do, you could do CME through it. And frankly, you could do maintenance of certification through an automatic CME system through it, like UpToDate. If people were developing those things, doctors would buy them.
Well, you know, the trouble is, you know, with meaningful use, obviously there's no incentive for them to do that. So the
right.
products we have look like banking software or airline software or grocery store software, and they just assume that, you know, everything that they learned revolutionizing those industries, that it was just a matter of copy-paste and bring that over to medicine. And you know, I wish we could get a movement together, Dick, to sort of get these health IT people into doctors' offices so that they could learn you know, how it is that we do what we do. A lot of times I'll tell a story about my aunt Paula, my mom's sister. She was a computer programmer for many years and worked for U.S. Air doing software. She designed the software to keep up with airplane maintenance. And the first thing that she did is she went down to the hangar and watched the folks working on airframes and jet engines and control surfaces, and they all looked at her and said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And she says, "Well, I'm about to write a bunch of software that, you know, monitors and controls how you do what you do, and I can't do that unless I understand how you do what you do." Right. And that same thing has to happen in healthcare. And you know, you don't see health IT people hanging around doctor's offices. Occasionally, we'll get a couple coming through mine. But, you know, things like that have to happen for them to understand how we do it and how to make products that can support what we do instead of getting in the way like they do now.
Right, and there's actually been systems designed like that by independent people. There's one of the surgeons that talks on the ACS blog is from Omaha, Nebraska. He and a group of people developed a system like that, and they actually went into offices and spent months and months and videotaped people's workflows and so that they could actually understand how to build a product that helped you get through your day better. But what has happened, and you know this, is that there are other major players involved, and so our EMRs are all built on the medical billing and coding architecture. And they've made doctors into the medical billing and coding clerks instead of the professional practitioners that we need to be. And it takes an incredible amount of time away from patient care and interferes with it.
And some of the blame there, and of course you know this too, goes to the structure of the CPT and ICD-9/10 coding system that we have to live with in the first place. Before meaningful use, the only hook that EMR vendors had was to say that we can support your level of documentation and let you code for higher visits, the codes you know you already deserve, but you don't have the energy to document. But, you know, thanks to the CPT thing, yes, these things have to, you know, when a doctor and a patient get together in an exam room, it's not an opportunity to build a relationship and deliver, you know, compassionate, competent care. It is a billing event.
Yes,
and
right.
That's part of the underlying problem.
It's an intrusion and a distraction. And I think one of the things that needs to happen as I said, mainstream this issue is explain to the software developers and to the larger organizations that we don't need to really attack CPT and ICD anymore. It's a dictionary. It's just a way to describe what we do. But it doesn't have to run in the front of these user interfaces. It could be in the background.
Yes.
So doctors don't have to deal with it. They just do their work every day. And someone else deals down the line with the coding and billing issues. And as long as that software can translate what you've documented that you do every day, you can continue to take care of patients. And you don't worry about the dictionary. It's like most of us don't worry about the dictionary in Microsoft Word. It's just there in the background to help us if we need it, but it doesn't run in the front. We don't have to define words as we type.
True, but I think in some of the CPT criteria, this goes way back to managed care, when you know they would try to downcode what you were doing based on documentation minutia.
Right.
And you know, there's got to be, I think, some give there so that you know we're rewarded for our cognitive work.
Right.
And you know, a part of the problem with EMRs is that because of the documentation requirements, the automation turns, you know, what could be a couple of paragraphs about a patient that just has the meat of what's going on. Here was their problem. Here was the story. Here's the physical findings. Here's the diagnosis. Here's the plan. Do it in a few paragraphs. That becomes 6 pages of single-spaced, small font, white noise, and it becomes very difficult to, you know, for anybody to figure out, you know, where's the relevant data in this long note.
So that can lead us into another conversation about something that's really revolutionary, and that means that if you don't want to deal with CPT codes and ICD codes and third-party payers, then you just throw those all out the window and practice medicine.
Exactly. And
it's called direct primary care.
Yes, and you know this may be a huge revolution in how healthcare is delivered, and once again, I'm going to get out of the way and let you tell everybody about it.
Well, there's some interesting things going on nationally, and you know that our foundation president, Lee Gross, is one of the leaders in this, who developed the Epiphany program in Florida. And it's a very exciting thing. And for the people that are listening that aren't physicians, think back prior to 1965, prior to Medicare. Most people in the United States wouldn't really think about going to their doctor visit and having their insurance company pick up the tab. They just, the doctor visit was pretty cheap back then because primary care is very inexpensive. And they would go to their doctor, and maybe the visit would cost $8 or $10, and they'd just pay it or write a check. Well, if you leap forward 4 or 5 decades, this can still be done and in a direct primary care practice. And we have some great examples of that on CIRMO. Lee Gross is one. Josh Umbrer from Josh from Atlas MD in Kansas City is another. They devised their direct primary care practice straight out of residency, and they built their own EMR system to support that practice that doesn't have anything to do with coding and billing. So the way it works is just like a health club membership. You pay $50 a month per adult, and you get a certain number of visits per year. You get your preventative care. You get everything you need, and you don't have any time constraints on your time with the doctor. And the other thing that that does is it allows the physician to communicate with you in all kinds of new and innovative ways. And just to point that out, how that works, for instance, Josh told me that on a Monday morning, he'll often go in and have a cup of coffee and sit down and answer 50 patient emails, because these people don't need to come into the office and sit there for an hour to get their test results. He can just talk to them on email about it. And then maybe 4 or 5 of those people will need to come to the office to see him, so he sees them in the afternoon, and he can spend as much time as he wants with them, and he doesn't have to do any type of EMR coding or billing work. They just get care. And so this has been described as a combination between Marcus Welby and Stephen Jobs, direct primary care for the 21st century, and it's really taking off.
Well, think about what that means, Dick. I mean, that example that you give is perfect, because of the 50 emails that he goes through, you know, if all those patients had to come into the office, I mean, think about the expense to the system. I mean, it's almost irrelevant who's actually paying for it, but all those patients need to be checked in, checked out, claims generated, you know, a whole expensive healthcare machine has to evolve or swirl around those 50 patients who maybe just had a simple question that could be answered, and, you know, you do it for pennies by email as opposed to, you know, $100 per person if all 50 of those folks needed to come in.
Not only that, but for the patient, it's very convenient because they don't want to take time off work to come and sit in an office to find out what their blood glucose is or their A1C or how they have to change their dose on their medication. They just want to communicate with their doctor, and they know they can do it seamlessly as part of their subscription fee to the service. And it's really revolutionary. I mean, you've been there when Lee has given his talks about the Epiphany program, and people that aren't familiar with it, their jaw drops because they can't believe how inexpensive it is and how accessible it is for people, and it's really amazing.
Well, I think the one that I've seen Lee present is the emergency room visit for belly pain.
That's right.
That was about $20,000 and change when the patient went to the emergency room. If they had gone to a direct for primary care model, the bill would have been less than $1,000, maybe
$250. Well, actually, it was about $300.
Yeah, it was about $300. And again, this is exactly the same stuff. This is truly apples to apples. This isn't that the patient went to the primary doc in a direct primary care setting and they decided the tests weren't needed. It was all the same stuff. So it was very close to an apples to apples comparison, if I understand it correctly.
That's right. And so if we're talking about doing things to, quote, bend the cost curve down in healthcare, there you have it right there.
Yeah.
You can reduce, as far as the coding and billing part, it's been estimated that they can reduce their office overhead by about 40%. And so they don't need as many employees. They can make a good living based upon about 600 patients per a direct primary care panel. And it just makes sense. Not only that, you're providing people with quality care that they actually like. And that's one of the problems that we've had to deal with so often. In fact, when I 2 years ago, I testified before the House Oversight Committee about this and talked to them about how the physician-patient relationship was being destroyed. And ultimately, what it comes down to is doctors really do want to take care of people, and patients really do want to spend time with us, but we have all these external intrusions that interfere with that, and direct primary care solves that problem. It gets rid of it.
So in the last segment, because we're about done with segment number three, 44 minutes after the hour, we're going to talk about how you put this all together. If you're one of the docs that is waking up to all this and you're angry and you're frustrated and you've decided it's time to do something about it, we're going to talk in the last segment. Dick's going to tell us, you know, what do you do besides get mad around the water cooler? You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to The Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, host of Detailing Addiction and medical director of the Atlanta Healing Center. Please join me on Tuesday afternoons at 4 p.m.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. With us by phone from the beautiful Upper Peninsula of Michigan is Dr. Richard Armstrong. And we are entering what may be the most important segment of the program, Dick, which is, you know, how do docs that are becoming a part of this rapidly growing group of folks who have finally become frustrated enough to try and do something about what's going on, what is it that's going to happen? We probably ought to start with the history of our own group, I suppose.
Well, yeah, and we won't belabor that because it'll just take some time. But basically, what's happening now, which we anticipated, is that several things have occurred. The Republicans took the Senate, and that kind of spurred people on a little bit. The Supreme Court decided to take up the King versus Burwell case, which is the case that people may know about, to decide whether the Affordable Care Act really said that the subsidies could not be doled out to patients in states where the federal government runs the exchanges, and there's about 37 of those states. And it was interesting because, you know, and I know that Jonathan Gruber was very honest and said, well, of course the law was written that way because we tried to stimulate the states to build their own exchanges, so it'll be an interesting deal. And see, the thing that's spurring a lot of these doctors on right now is they feel that if the Supreme Court decides that the states that have federal exchanges can't pay the subsidies, that the Republican Congress will have an opening to change things. Now, how the Republican Congress responds to that will be very interesting. And what everybody is concerned about is, does the GOP have a plan? Well, that comes back to doctor patient care and how we began. In May of 2009, in Hal Scher's office in Atlanta, about 40 doctors got together because of the same thing was happening. People were frustrated about the potential government plans for this, quote, takeover of healthcare, and they didn't quite know what to do. And so Hal asked Congressman Tom Price for some help, and Tom said, form a new organization. So they did that. 40 doctors in one office did that, and it spread as a political advocacy group, just to go to Washington and hold up signs and give speeches, and then as a more complicated issue, after about 9 months of this, to several people to form a new organization developed, and so a membership organization, which is a 501c6 under the IRS designation, just like the AMA, formed. And everybody was excited and got involved, and everybody that was excited and got involved was also naive. And what I mean by that, it's not a derogatory phrase. What I mean by that is none of us really knew how to build a business of a new membership organization. None of us really knew the ins and outs of political advocacy for health policy changes, and really none of us, although we had some ideas, were health policy experts. Now, you know, doctors are smart people, and doctors are well-educated in medicine, and we know what to do with medicine. We know how to take care of patients. But doctors aren't healthcare policy experts. We're not economists. We didn't go to school for that. You know, we're not political experts, people that know how to navigate the complexities of the political system. And so we have a tendency to think that, well, let's have a meeting in Washington and we'll all get an airplane ticket and we'll go there and we're going to just sit down in a room and we're going to tell these guys what to do and it's going to happen. Well, it's nice to have that enthusiasm.
Didn't quite work out that way,
It doesn't work out that way. And the deeper that you get into this, and that's one of the things I'll mention here, is that you find out that you have to really educate yourself and the issues are incredibly complicated. And in order to navigate those things, you have to become tremendously involved. And this has become a full-time job for several of us, including you, and really ended up with us forming the Doctor Patient Care Foundation so that we could continue this educational effort nationally and have some type of an effect on policy. And I'll just give one example that we have talked about in Michigan. This involves forming relationships, and it involves forming trusting relationships with people all over the country. In 2013, several of the groups got together in Ann Arbor, Michigan to talk about a bunch of these ideas, and Lee Gross was there to talk about Epiphany Primary Care, and there was another state senator from Michigan, Patrick Kolbeck, there, who was interested in direct primary care. And Beth Haynes was there from the Benjamin Rush Institute, who many of us all know, who it's an organization that helps teach medical students about different creative free market ideas in healthcare. And Pat Kolbeck was interested in promoting direct primary care in Michigan, but there was a barrier, and the barrier was the Michigan insurance code. And so Lee and Pat began to talk, and Beth and Pat and Lee began to talk, and then one of the students from the Benjamin Rush Institute, who goes to Georgetown, got a summer internship at the Heritage Foundation, which they offer to teach medical students about healthcare policy, and wrote a paper about direct primary care last August. Well, Pat Kolbeck picked up that paper, and he used that paper to teach the legislators in the Senate and the House in Michigan about what direct primary care is and what were the barriers to developing direct primary care practices in Michigan. Pat wrote the legislation with another senator from Michigan. They introduced it last fall. It went through the Senate and the House, and it was just this past week signed by Governor Snyder of Michigan, and we changed the insurance code in Michigan so that direct primary care practices are protected from being regulated as insurance plans. Now, that took 2 years.
And that took 2 years of relationship building, of research and education.
Mike?
Yes.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it took 2 years of research and education. It took 2 years of relationship building. It took 2 years of convincing. And, you know, it's an excellent example of how much we've learned in 5 years. That it's not enough just to be angry. It's not enough just to get together with a bunch of your colleagues and be angry, or go to Washington and just be angry. You have to think it through. You've got to get smart, and you've got to learn the strategy and do the groundwork and devote the time and effort to do it the right way.
Right. And so the bottom line in this little last segment is that I am incredibly encouraged that there are all these doctors from around the country that are coming together and becoming interested. And one in particular, one group, an orthopedic surgeon from California, Dr. Dan Craviato wrote an article called The Declaration of Independence for Physicians or something in the Wall Street Journal last April, and it spurred people on again. It was kind of a call to action. So he and some other physician friends formed another group called the United Physicians and Surgeons of America, and they decided that they wanted to put on this summit meeting in Colorado in this summer in July, and they're promoting that now. And I've spoken with them, and they wondered, why are you encouraging us? And I said, because this is wonderful. I mean, this is wonderful that you're getting people together. It's wonderful that you're doing this. And I encourage you, and I also encourage you to educate yourselves and learn about these things. And they are doing a lot of things right. I mean, they've hired a professional public relations firm. They hired a professional event organizer. So they're doing these things right, and we'll have to see how this develops. But it's the kind of venue that could bring people together in a room to talk about some of these issues spurred on by the EMR and the maintenance of certification issues and possibly result in some positive things. The caution is that this takes time and that, you know, your expectations are very high at the beginning, and doctors, as we talked about at the beginning, are busy, not connected. And, you know, you have to structure these kind of venues so that you actually get some goal out of it, something actionable, something that you can do something about. That would be my advice after all the things that we've been through for the last 6 years.
So we got about a minute and a half left in the show, Dick. So I guess the last question I'll throw out to you is if you're listening to this and you're listening to us talking, you feel like you're motivated now, but you're by yourself, you really don't have any colleagues you've talked about, what are a couple of steps that an individual can take to connect themselves with this movement? And I guess I would start the list with joining CIRMO and getting on there and getting educated, but can you take that idea and sort of run with it?
Sure. Well, I would say that to self-educate, you need to join CIRMO and not be afraid to get involved in the conversations. There can be a lot of noise on CIRMO. There's a lot of political fighting that goes on, and you have to get past all that, and you have to be able to have a thick skin sometimes and be constructive and keep going back to the points and debate the substance. If you like to teach medical students, you can become involved with the Benjamin Rush Institute, and Beth would love that. If you're near a medical school and you want to get involved teaching medical students about creative, new, innovative ideas in healthcare, that would be a way to go. If you want to help the Doctor Patient Care Foundation educate the public, legislators, and other colleagues, you can go to our website and read our Physician's Prescription for Healthcare Reform, which is kind of the Doctor Patient Care Foundation's constitution in a way. I mean, if you read those points, what I tell people is, if you took a group of people who were objective and had them examine the healthcare system in America from the beginning till now, and you figured out the root problems that caused the dysfunction that we all see, and you wanted to start to move toward fixing it, these are the points that I think just about everybody would come up with. And I say that not to promote that so much, but to just tell the truth. And I mean, people get involved in ideological discussions where they want something like, okay, well, we have to have single payer. Well, I think we had an object lesson recently from Vermont that they wanted single payer in Vermont, and they did the studies in Vermont, and the governor, who's a Democrat, said the math doesn't work. We can't do it.
So we've kind of reached the top. I wish we had another hour because you've got lots of wisdom to share. But I think this is a very important show. I think you know, this is the message here: is that if you've had it, you know, there are ways to do intelligent things with the frustration that you feel. Join CIRMO, do the things Dr. Armstrong's talking about. We'll probably talk about this more in a couple of weeks. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, sir.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.